Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the first day of September already. Last week marked 20 years since there was a failed coup that precipitated the breakup of the Soviet Union. There are now 15 new independent countries. Jim Hines from the Associated Press said that triumphalists in the West saw the USSR's disintegration as the inevitable triumph of democracy, even as the end of history. Others, like Russian leader Vladimir Putin, bemoaned the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. The shards of the Soviet Union, he writes, lie somewhere between those extremes, a jumbled pile of countries totaling one-sixth of the world's landmass that are wildly different from each other and facing futures ranging from promising to troubling to anyone's guess. Islamic insurgencies threaten to explode into wide fighting, and two frozen conflicts appear nowhere near resolution. We're going to be talking about what happened since the Soviet Union fell apart this hour of our program. Our guest is Professor Ronald Suny, director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies and the Charles Tilly Collegiate Professor of Social and Political History at the University of Michigan. Emeritus Professor of Political Science and History of the at the University of Chicago. He's author of The Revenge of the Past, Nationalism, Revolution, and the Collapse of the Soviet Union, and The Soviet Experiment, Russia, the USSR, and the Successor States. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Ronald Suny, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Why don't we start with a little bit of a history lesson? Please refresh our memories about the failed coup that took place 20 years ago last week.
I can remember that day very well.
Really?
I'm sure many people in Russia and other parts of the Soviet Union remember it as well. There was a small group of conservative, I'll call them conservative communists, people who feared the kinds of changes that Gorbachev was carrying out, who wanted to reverse particularly the major reform that was contemplated then in August 1991, which was a new constitution, a new treaty called the Union Treaty between the 15 republics of the former Soviet Union, of the Soviet Union at the time. And this would have created a looser federation or confederation, giving these various republics many more rights, almost making them independent, at least autonomous states. And that was really frightening to these leaders of the KGB, the secret police, the vice president of the Soviet Union, Yanayev, and others. And so when Gorbachev, unwisely, he admits that today, went on vacation in Crimea, they used that opportunity to seize power in Moscow. They were extremely disorganized. They were quite inebriated, in fact. They had little confidence about what they were doing. They were incompetent. They failed to carry out the arrest of the leader of the Russian Republic, Boris Yeltsin. And so in 3 days, with only about three people actually being killed, three protesters, the coup failed. Gorbachev returned to Moscow, but the world had changed.
Mm-hmm.
His power had been totally undermined. He was still head of the Communist Party. He had to dissolve the Communist Party. He lost his base of support. And Yeltsin used that opportunity to increase his power. And eventually, a few months later in December, he, by his signature, with agreeing with the leaders of Ukraine and Belarus, ended the Soviet Union.
Why in the world did Gorbachev go on vacation?
I think he was exhausted. He had been negotiating fiercely during those last months to get this union treaty. Each of the republics was going their own way, and something had to be done to hold the whole thing together. And he had the agreement of most of them. Yeltsin was seemingly the most reluctant to sign this treaty at one point. But in general, I think it was, basically, he was only going for a few days, and it was probably exhaustion. But obviously, it was a terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what's happened to some of those countries, and it's all over the map here, starting, of course, with the one that may be most important, which is Russia. This AP article that I was reading said that Russia is among the not free, losing ground over the past decade. It's the one with the most lavish treasure chest of natural resources, the only one to have nuclear weapons. The path that they choose is of concern to us, but the path is far from clear. Do you agree with that?
I think that's right. You remember 20 years ago, there was tremendous enthusiasm that these countries who had just shaken off the authoritarian rule of these communist parties would gravitate almost inevitably to democratic politics and capitalist, that is, market economy. And the markets certainly developed. That is, most of these states are basically capitalist market economies. But on the political side, there was a real failure. That is, most of these countries, with the exception of the Baltic republics, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, have in fact moved toward more authoritarian regimes. And that's been led by Russia. Yeltsin himself, who took power after Gorbachev, after the end of the Soviet Union, was a, I would say, sincere Democrat. That is, he wanted a freer society, free elections, etc. And yet, of course, like most politicians, he wanted to preserve his own power, and he feared particularly the return of the now very reactionary Communist Party led by Zhuganov. And so he played with the rules of the game. He abolished one constitution. He led a kind of coup against the parliament. He manipulated elections. And eventually, he even appointed his successor, Vladimir Putin, formerly of the KGB, who would carry out from Yeltsin's more democratic society a more a gradual move into a more authoritarian, almost one-party state.
And tell me about where everybody studied democracy and what kind of government they were fashioning. You have a country that has been the complete opposite for such a long period of time. I don't know how you all of a sudden switch to a democracy. Who helps you?
Well, I think their models were taken from the West. That is, they would look westward and they saw that the West was more prosperous, seemed to be a more pleasant place to live, was freer in many ways, people traveled, and so forth. And people in Russia and the former Soviet Union could vision this. They could see this on television, in movies, in what they read. This was a very educated population. And so they imagined that if they had a market economy, if they had a more democratic political system, that they could replicate the West. It was said at the time, in fact, they would like to have had a democracy like the United States, a welfare system like Sweden, but they wanted to work as they did in Russia, which means not that much. And that, of course, combination doesn't really work. What's surprising about Russia is in the episodes in the 20th century, when the people have been given a little leeway, a little bit of freedom to express themselves, despite the fact that they've lived under this authoritarian regime, they managed to create democratic, let's say, movements. So if you look back right before the revolution, after, say, the revolution of 1905, there were efforts to make a more democratic, a more liberal country, more liberal political system. And the same was true in the Gorbachev period. As soon as Gorbachev, after, let's say, 1986, 1987, began to liberalize and give people the possibility of speaking out freely, of participating in elections, it was unbelievable, you know, how spontaneously, how quickly they organized, they formed movements, they spoke out, they carried out election campaigns. I mean, the possibilities are there. The interesting paradox in Russia is that the Russian people have sort of democratic values. They're interested in a democratic system, in greater freedom of travel, of expression, of protest, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But, and here's a big but, at the same time they're for these democratic values, one, they understand that they don't have it in Russia, and two, when push comes to shove, their own fears about the future leave them to opt for order rather than greater chaos.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So whereas Yeltsin was quite freewheeling and democratic in many ways, the country was falling apart. And Putin, who is more authoritarian, brought order and greater prosperity. And therefore, he's one of the most popular politicians in the world today in his own country.
And by order and prosperity, are you talking about jobs?
I mean jobs, yes.
Yeah.
I understand I'm talking to Wisconsin. Yes,
right.
And from Michigan, which has the highest unemployment numbers probably in the country at this time. Yeah, no, jobs. And, the economy is growing. It was growing in Russia. They suffered a little bit during this downturn. Putin, of course, is not totally responsible for this. Whereas during Gorbachev's time, world oil prices fell, and Russia is one of the largest, if not the largest, exporter of oil in the world, oil and gas. So Gorbachev suffered from that downturn. During Putin's time, they were increasing. And so lots of cash was flowing into the country, and that could be that could help bolster his regime.
So what do you call his regime? Is it nominally a democracy? Is it an authoritarian government? Is it part communist? What is it?
That's a good question. And I can refer you to the political science literature, which has all kinds of names for him, everything from autocratic to directed democracy. I call it sort of facade democracy. That is, on the surface, it looks democratic. There actually are elections. There are various parties. There is a relatively free press. The mass media, like television, is controlled very heavily by the state. But there are possibilities of having free discussion. There are restrictions on protests or demonstrations. So it looks somewhat democratic. And yet, when you actually examine it, basically, one party dominates, United Russia. This is Putin's party, of which Medvedev, the current president, is also part. And there will be possibly a contest between the two. But in fact, this party handpicks the one who's going to run. And eventually, one leader picks the other. Yeltsin picked Putin. Putin picked Medvedev. Now there's a little bit of decision about which one will come out on top, Putin being the far stronger one. But basically, ultimately, the outcome is known before the election.
And is Putin running next spring?
I would bet money on his running next spring, and I think he will be the next president. I think this was a kind of gambit he wasn't allowed to run for a third term. He appointed his loyal satrap Medvedev. Of course, once Medvedev was enjoying the trappings of being president, he himself has those kinds of ambitions. What they actually decide and how they'll work it out is not clear, but I would be surprised if Putin didn't run and win.
I must say that I was really taken aback when you said that Putin is probably the most popular leader in the world. We, of course, don't hear very much about him here or think of him in that regard. Why is he so wildly popular?
Well, you'd have to go back to the 90s and see how desperate the situation was in Russia. Yeltsin, who was very celebrated in the West, and particularly in the United States, a friend of Bill Clinton's and seen as a Democrat and so forth, created a system with his new constitution in 1993 of a strong presidency. But within that strong presidency, Yeltsin himself was rather weak. He was himself sick. He was undergoing heart problems. He was alcoholic. So you had a strong presidency, but a weak leader. And during those years, Russia did badly. In 1998, there was an economic collapse. So he was very unpopular. The state was falling apart. There was crime was rampant. But then when Putin came into power, he very quickly, I would call him a kind of muscular president. He, in fact, is quite well built and so forth. He's an athlete. But he suddenly, instead of this bumbling, alcoholic, decrepit leader, Yeltsin was this young, dynamic leader. He had all the imagery that you need for a strong leader was there. And very quickly, he showed how strong he was. He took a very fierce and even brutal policy toward the Chechen rebellion in the south of Russia. And then he benefited from the upturn in oil prices and in the economy. And so, and because the state was so weak, because local leaders weren't paying attention to Moscow, he began to centralize power in Moscow. That, too, proved to be, to a certain degree, popular with many people in Russia. So he brought a kind of order out of chaos, prosperity out of despair. And, of course, those kinds of things make people popular.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We've yet to talk about the other countries. How are they faring? How many are considered democracies and free? How many are very poor? How many are doing well? How many have really severe problems? We'll look at all of that as we continue our conversation with Professor Ronald Suny, director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies and the Charles Tilly Collegiate Professor of Social and Political History at the University of Michigan. He's also emeritus professor of political science and history at the University of Chicago. And here is our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, starting with Deb in Wauwatosa. Hi, Deb.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that I was in Russia in December of 2000, and it was we stayed everywhere from a high-scale hotel, Americanized hotel in Moscow, to an $8-a-night communist hotel, to living with a family. And what we found to be the case was that many of the older generation in Russia felt that they were not going to see democracy do anything good for them in their lifetime and would have preferred for it to go back to a communist regime. Whereas the younger generation seemed, although they were struggling and it was a very difficult time, that they felt that there was hope in their lifetime, that they were going to see something positive. The other issue that happened during that year that I wanted to speak of, which didn't boost their confidence in communism, was, if you'll recall, in December of 2000, we didn't know in the United States exactly who our president was. We were having trouble with our elections. So that was a kind of an interesting time to be there, and just wanted to mention our observations.
Professor.
Yes, it sounds exactly right. There are generational differences, obviously. Older generation lived under the Soviet Union. Many of them experienced the terrible times under Stalin and the really devastating times during World War II. They celebrated the victory over fascism. It was, after all, the Soviet Union that basically defeated Nazi Germany. And so they were very proud of the Soviet Union and saw a degree of stability, of reasonable expectation of what the future held, and so forth. Then suddenly along comes so-called democracy, the collapse, impoverization of great numbers of people, chaos, crime, ethnic violence, wars in Karabakh, civil war in Tajikistan in which 50,000 are killed. Well, suddenly democracy seems to be allied with a very poor living, insecurity, unpredictability, and you can see how these people would be disillusioned. And so for that generation particularly, there grew up a kind of Soviet nostalgia. They drew an overly rosy picture of the way things had been, particularly in the Brezhnev period, the period before Gorbachev and the end of the Soviet Union. And they imagined that things had been very, very easy for them then. Of course, there had been lines, but their children could go to school, they'd go to university for free, health care was available, their lives were in many ways easier, and they could understand that system. Now, with this new democratic and capitalist system, they had a great difficulty trying to understand how to make a living. And I remember in those years of the 90s how you'd see older people on the street selling whatever they could, their underwear even, socks, anything they brought out of their homes in order to make ends meet. So it was a really terrible time.
Yeah. Thanks, Deb, very much for your reminiscences. Matt in Madison, hi.
Hello?
Yeah, Matt, hi.
Good. I just had two quick questions for the professor, and then I'll get off the line. I've read Marx, and I've just always found it really curious that, because if you're searching for economic equality, it seems like a no-brainer that democracy or political equality would go hand-in-hand with that, and I was just curious why you think Marx would have left that out of his theory. And the second question real quick is, just if you think the USSR would have been more, or other communist regimes would have been more successful had they had democracy embedded within the system from the very beginning instead of these authoritarian regimes. So, okay, I'll get off the line. Thanks.
Thanks, Matt.
These are very interesting questions. And this might be somewhat a subjective answer when I give it to you. But first of all, obviously, since I've taught Soviet history and related subjects for 40 years, I've read a lot of Marx. And Marx, in a funny way, you could call a radical democrat. That is, his idea was that socialism had to be democratic, that it was the rule of working people over those who owned property and the means of production. And so he wanted to spread democracy not only to the political realm, but also to the economic realm. How that was going to be done was not spelled out well in his theory. That was clear. And he writes very little about what socialism would actually look like. But even Lenin, I'm just finishing a book on the young Stalin up to the revolution of 1917, and I'm surprised how the Bolsheviks, that is the party that became the communists and took power in 1917, how they talked about democracy. They wanted to create a kind of democracy, at least they talked about it, up to the revolution, that would then allow the working class to organize and speak freely, become conscious, and then begin to build socialism. All of that seems to have gone out the window once the Bolsheviks took power. And so what you got in Russia and in the Soviet Union was a thing which we can put in quotes, socialism, but I'd call it state socialism, which was not democratic, which was about, empowering the working class, but the working class was not given any power, and it was a very dictatorial and authoritarian regime. And so socialism has come down to us to mean this authoritarian regime, this planned economy, everything from the center, no markets, etc., rather than its original message, which was this extended democracy.
We should spend a little while before we go back to phone calls talking about the other republics. When you read about their populations, when you read about what has happened to them, it's hard to believe that all of them were together in the Soviet Union for even a day, because they're entirely different frames of references as to what continents they seem to be more aligned with, what their structures are, what their population bases are. How many are faring well, and how many are in deep trouble right now?
Most are in some kind of trouble, I'm sorry to report. Some are doing well, like let's say Kazakhstan is doing well economically, because guess what? They have oil and gas.
Mm-hmm.
Or Azerbaijan is doing well economically because there's oil and gas in the Caspian Sea. But both Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, all of the Central Asian republics, are in fact authoritarian regimes. Many of them, like Kazakhstan, in fact, still have the old communist leader now redressed, sort of, now disguised as a national democratic leader. In Azerbaijan, the leader is Ilham Aliyev, who's the son of the last his father was, in fact, a communist leader, a member of the Soviet Politburo, etc. So these countries are not doing well politically, authoritarian. They're certainly authoritarian, but some of them are doing well economically. Others not. I mean, Armenia is having a very bad... Armenia is the smallest in territory of the former Soviet republics. A good 40% of that population of Armenia has migrated either to Russia...
Really? Oh, my.
Yes, it's terrible. It's kind of what they call a white genocide. The leaking out of this population, particularly educated people, to Russia and to Glendale, California.
So Glendale, California?
Yeah, there's a big Armenian community there.
Oh,
Georgia went through civil wars, a Rose Revolution, very democratic aspirations under this young, dynamic leader, Mikhail Saakashvili. He's become more authoritarian. And, of course, he led Georgia into a war with Russia in 2008. So one by one, these countries have not done so well. The Baltic countries, as I mentioned, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, they're the ones that have done well in their democratic politics. Some of them are suffering now, of course, with this global crisis, since they are also involved in the European economic system.
Mm-hmm. Helen in Madison, hi.
Yes. How would you rank the quality of U.S. democracy compared to Russia, Europe, Scandinavia, especially with the domination of corporations and Wall Street and the intertwining of those entities with our government?
Well, there's a question for you, sir.
Oh, that's a very good, a very provocative question.
It sure is.
Clearly, America is quite democratic, but I would call it a bourgeois democracy. That is, this is a free country in which there are contested elections, a relatively free press, but money talks. And you'll notice in the next months in this in the United States, it's all going to be about how much money Obama can raise, how much money the Republicans can raise, which Republican will raise it. So money talks through elections, through control of the media, who can buy ads on TV, whether Fox will be in favor of this candidate or that candidate, as well as lobbies and so forth. So, yes, it's very democratic, maybe not as democratic, certainly not as democratic as some of the European social democratic countries like Sweden or Norway or Denmark, but very democratic, but in this limited way. And we often identify democracy with the system we have rather than thinking of ways that we can make it truly representative by somehow controlling this rather plutocratic dominance in our country.
In Wisconsin, we're just in favor of the Green Bay Packers. Did you? I don't know if you heard the news this morning, but the NBC affiliate has decided they will skip the president's address because the Green Bay Packers are playing their opener.
Yes, that's important, I guess.
Right. All right, Helen, thank you. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. So something the guest said sort of set me back on my heels a little bit. I had the opportunity over the decades to get to know a lot of Russians, especially during the Soviet period. And, you know, people connected with embassies, et cetera, et cetera. These were educated people, granted, English-speaking. They were living here in America. But they were dedicated communists. They were people who worked for their country. And, you know, the thing that I heard over and over and over again from these people was that living in America, they just shake their heads and they don't understand how a country like ours even functions, because they said it's so chaotic. I said, you know, nobody determines how many TV sets are made. Nobody determines, you know, anything. He says, and whether you make it as a make a success economically is determined by so many factors that are beyond any single person's individual control. They don't understand how a system like ours could possibly work for long, and that they valued stability over the general message I got was that the Russians really, one, they don't understand democracy in the sense that Americans understand it, and what they do and the ones who do understand it don't like it very much. So the idea that Russians are interested in democracy and Russians have always liked the idea of democracy sort of set me back on my heels, because it seems to me that if Russia wanted democracy, they'd have it.
Thanks, Bill, for your comments. Professor Suning.
Yeah, well, I would say let's make a distinction between the economic system, capitalism, or market economies, if you prefer, and a democratic political system. It's the democratic values of free speech, of contested elections, of those kinds of things, right to assembly, sort of things we have in our Bill of Rights, that in most polls that are taken, most surveys in Russia, Russians overwhelmingly support. What they fear is, and what I meant to say before, was that democracy very much was equated in their real experience, lived experience, with the chaos they had experienced during the 1990s. So many people became disillusioned with, you could say, actually existing democracy rather than the values of democracy. On the chaos side, what they most would have trouble with is the freewheeling market economy. That is something that they are not used to. Things were planned, prices were stable. Suddenly, with the opening, with the end of the Soviet Union, prices went sky high. That was very difficult for them.
And thanks, Bill, very much for the call. Let's go next to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. One of my great fears for democracy is the influence of religion within democratic systems. And if I'm not mistaken, Putin, for most of his life, was either a-religious, irreligious, or non-religious, however you want to put it. But very soon after, he changed and, I would say, reverted to orthodoxy. And I do know that, depending on which Soviet Socialist Republic you're looking at, religion is either an extremely strong influence. I visited Lithuania soon after the changes, and I was struck by the immense religiosity of the people, which is also part of a nationalistic expression, but also the immense influence of the Catholic Church in that particular democracy. My question is, in Russia itself, is there a sort of alliance between orthodoxy and authoritarianism, that is, authoritarianism within a church system or religious system, and authoritarianism within a government or state system? Is there cooperation there between the two in a way that is to be monitored and watched?
That's a very good question, and I would say the answer to the last point you made is yes. That is, the Orthodox Church is a kind of hierarchical, hierarchic, if you will, church, and does support a strong state, and even made accommodations with the communist state, uncomfortably, obviously, but they had to survive, and also is now allied with Putin to a very large degree. I don't think Putin is particularly orthodox himself, though obviously leaders have to pretend or pose as agreeing with the major religion, since that helps them win elections or authority. Republics are different, though. You're absolutely right that Lithuania is one of the strongest in terms of their religion, very Catholic, much like their neighbor Poland. Even during Soviet times, I can remember, when I first went there, I would see people literally, during communism, kneeling on the street, praying to the icon of the Virgin Mary. I thought this was extraordinary. So that remained, and that consciousness is very strong in Lithuania. In Georgia, the Orthodox Church there is allied to the government and has some serious influence. I would argue that part of the reason for this in many of these countries is that the old ideology, the way the world was explained, which was Marxism-Leninism or communism, disappeared. It eroded. It vanished. And in its place, people searched for other ways of understanding the world. And it may be, in some cases, Islam or radical Islam. And there are such movements. They're not that strong. The authoritarian states in Central Asia and in Azerbaijan keep down these movements. But still, people are looking for alternatives to the official government and to the old ideology of communism, and they find it often in religion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Rich, for the call. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about a guy who ruled the country who captured our fancy for quite some time, and that's Mikhail Gorbachev, who was asked his thoughts about what's going on in Russia now and made a lot of news last week with his answers. He said that Russia should not repeat the mistake of the Soviet Union in being ruled a monopoly. He said, in short, I am unhappy. We are ranked lowest together with African countries in terms of mortality rate, and half the numbers of people receive education compared with the post-war years. Are his concerns valid, and does anybody listen to what he says?
Yes, his concerns are valid, and few people listen to what he says. Gorbachev is, of course, one of the great heroic and tragic figures of the 20th century. He's largely irrelevant in Russia today, sadly. He's someone you have to admire, but think about what he did. First of all, he tried to turn an authoritarian, some would say totalitarian state, into a democracy. He tried to end, ultimately, the command economy and make it into a market economy. He tried to end the empire of Russia over Eastern Europe and let those countries be freer. He tried to end the Cold War and bring about a greater understanding and cooperation between East and West, and he destroyed his country. His reign led to economic collapse, to the breakup of the Soviet Union, which many people thought was a good thing. I mean, many people in the West thought it was a good thing to break it up. Many people in that part of the world think it was a bad thing. And created all kinds of inter-ethnic conflicts and so forth. So on the one hand, tremendous ambitions and aspirations. On the other hand, abject failure to do that. And it's very interesting why that happened, why that collapse happened. But you can see how people are ambivalent about Gorbachev and why his popularity is way, way down.
Yeah. He should move here. He could be on all the nightly talk shows.
Yes.
Well, he could.
Speaking fees, too, yes.
Exactly. When you turn on the news, how many channels do you have? What are the news outlets like in Russia?
There are lots of channels in Russia, and it's quite free in one sense. That is, they have all kinds of programming, lots of pornography, silly sitcoms, foreign movies. They even have a show called Nostalgia, which is about remembering things about the Soviet Union. They actually have a whole show. They have a network called Nostalgia, which brings up things from the old days. But the news itself it's very sad, because one can remember, I've lived long enough to remember what Soviet news was like, where it was awful in the West and everything was progress in the Soviet Union, terribly censored. Then there was the period of Gorbachev, where it became freer and freer until everything was undermining the state and undermining Gorbachev and critical of everything. I could hardly think of a country that could survive that kind of onslaught. And then steadily under Putin, it's become more narrow, gone back to not quite the Soviet narrowness, but because it's much flashier now and the production values are much higher, but still highly restricted in various ways, very positive about Russia and negative about the West and others.
We're talking about the former Soviet Union. What's happened to Russia, to all the republics, where they stand now 20 years, which is hard to believe, since the Soviet Union fell apart. That was 20 years ago last week. Our guest is Professor Ronald Suny. He has been teaching Soviet history for 40 years now. He's director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies and the Charles Tilly Collegiate Professor of Social and Political History at the University of Michigan, also emeritus professor of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He is author of The Revenge of the Past, Nationalism, Revolution, and the Collapse of the Soviet Union, and The Soviet Experiment, Russia, the USSR, and the Successors States, And as you heard him say, he's currently writing a book on Lenin. We have phone calls open. We've been busy. Here's the number for you to call us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of the program this Thursday. She was a heck of a writer, this woman. In 1968, The New Yorker hired Ellen Willis as its first popular music critic. Her column, some of you may remember, Rock, Etc., ran for 7 years and established her as a leader in cultural commentary and a pioneer in the male-dominated field of rock criticism. She died in 2006. Her daughter is also a very gifted writer, and she has compiled, along with commentary, the columns that her mother Ellen wrote about, a beautiful column about Bob Dylan, the Velvet Underground, the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Joni Mitchell, Stevie Wonder, and many others. She's just really insightful about the music and the times and the politics. So her daughter will be with us to talk about the book, and her mom, and we'll listen to some music too. That's coming up, hour number two of our show. Back to phone calls. We go next to Jim in Waukesha. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call so quickly. My question is, what does the guest think Ronald Reagan's true effect was on the fall of the Soviet Union? You know, so many people say that, you know, he brought it down when, in fact, having, you know, known people from Europe, Germany specifically, who had visited the Soviet Union, it was rather obvious that, to me, that it was more of an internal failure as opposed to an external, you know, influence.
Well, that's a good question. Professor? Professor, are you there? And we lost him. Oh, if you could just hold on to that, Jim, I will ask him that question. We somehow have lost connection with our guest, who is Professor Ronald Suny, and he has been teaching Soviet history for 40 years. A splendid guest, I think, don't you? He's really quite knowledgeable and quite personable. So we will ask him that question in just one moment, as soon as we reestablish connection. He should be with us now. Professor, oh, there you are. The caller wondered about Ronald Reagan, who was given a great deal of credit for the fall of the Soviet Union. He was wondering, because of conversations he's had from people who knew the situation pretty well, if it was really more just a matter of internal chaos and an inevitable situation in the Soviet Union, and Ronald Reagan was able to step in and claim credit, or indeed, did he do something substantial to help bring the downfall of the Soviet Union?
That's a very good question, and it's something that comes up in class all the time. The real person who's responsible for the end of the Soviet Union, of course, is Gorbachev, not Reagan. But there is this myth that goes around that it was Reagan that caused it. And this is how the argument goes, that what Ronald Reagan did was raise the ante. He started the Star Wars program. He accelerated the arms race. He had a very tough anti-communist line, Mr. Gorbachev, bring down the wall, and so forth. And that led to the Soviet Union trying to compete, raise its arms budget, etc., and ultimately economic collapse followed. But that's not true. What happened instead, and here you have to give Reagan some credit, what happened was that Gorbachev decided not to fight the Cold War anymore, not to raise the arms budget, not to compete with Star Wars, but instead to negotiate with Reagan, with whom he saw an opening. That is, Reagan was in public a very, very brash and bold anti-communist, but he was actually quite shrewd in wanting to deal with the Soviet Union. And so he went to Reykjavik, and that one failed, but eventually he and Gorbachev started to lessen the arms race, bring down. He wouldn't give up Star Wars, which is, of course, a complete boondoggle and a waste of money, which we're still probably spending, but he was willing to deal with the Soviet Union. And so it wasn't so much Reagan's fierce anti-communism and hard line, but rather Reagan's opening to a softer line that allows the Gorbachev to think positively about his reforms. And ultimately, it was his reforms, the fact that he didn't know where he was going, that he was weakening the government, that the economy was not improving, that led to the end of the Soviet
Union. Fascinating. Yeah. Thank you, Jim, for your call. Phil in Golden Lake. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Great show. I've become friends with a Russian woman about my age, that's Cold War era. And she came over in 78, married an American. And I felt that my generation was greatly shaped by the nuclear threat of the Cold War. And talking with her about it, she had been like a young pioneer and all that, and she said that they really did not feel that threatened by it. They felt that if they were excellent, that their system would succeed, and apparently didn't live in that sort of fear of the nuclear blast that we did over here. And what's got me wondering, my question is, when I see the info about the current life expectancy in Russia, which is going down to, I think, something like 52 years for men.
Really?
That appears to be a lot of attrition from men in my generation. I'm now 66. And, you know, I just have to wonder how much disillusionment may be a part of that. That's my question.
Thank you.
Yes, that's a very good question.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you take those kinds of objective measures like life expectancy, infant mortality, suicide rates, drug use, etc., Russia is not doing well. That is, you have a government in Russia today which is about itself. It's politicians maybe enriching themselves or enjoying the fruits of power, but not thinking of what you could call the public good or the common good. And as bad as the Soviet system was in many ways, it was supposed to serve the common good. And so there was at least some delivering of goodies, limited as it was, to the general population. And the general population, more or less, not everyone, not dissenters, not intellectuals, but many people, the great majority, believe the system worked for them until near the end. And then real disillusionment began, starting in the Brezhnev period and accelerating in the Gorbachev period as more and more news came out about the failures of the system, the inadequacies, etc. So there was tremendous enthusiasm, and people did think they were on the right side of history. And you can imagine when they began to read about how the system actually worked, its own failures, its own limitations, how disillusioned they became.
Let's go to, thanks, Phil, for the call. Tim in Colorado. Hi.
Hey, I just finished a book, and nobody would talk to me about it because nobody was interested, but I think your listeners would, and it's called Travels in Siberia by Ian Fraser, who's a frequent contributor to The New Yorker.
Yes.
And I just found it quite interesting, even though he doesn't like do much, but he just travels, and it's about the culture of the people and the history of Russia. And I learned a couple things. One was, Russian culture is very, very, very different than ours, and they're just very radically different. And I also learned that Russia, since, you know, the Putin days, has become a natural resource gold mine or whatever, and they've turned their economy around, and now they have a surplus, et cetera, because they're producing so many natural resources, oil, natural gas, et cetera. And I have one other comment. I'd love to hear the comments from your guest. The other one was I learned that they seem to have not much interest in environmental protection. It's just not in their culture. And I learned things like there's a town in Siberia that he goes to where the average 200,000 people live there. The average winter temperature is minus 42 degrees, and this town sits on 1,300 feet of permafrost.
Professor Suni.
Russia is not California, I tell my students. It's a hard place. A huge percentage of the country is permafrost. They have problems with precipitation in some areas. They have deserts. They have all kinds of different ecological problems. And your guest is absolutely right that there has not been the kind of developed ecological consciousness that we thankfully find in this country. And given the fact that in Russia there's restrictions on the press, and secondly, that the people in power are so closely connected with the big money in the marketplace that is interested in exploiting the environment rather than safeguarding it, you can see how that kind of fatal link prevents an ecological movement from developing. Nevertheless, there are here and there very courageous people in Russia who are trying to save Lake Baikal or prevent further damage in some this place or that place. And so they should be supported and applauded, though it's a very fragile movement at the moment.
Well, thank you so much. I'd sure like to be in your class. You're great. No, you are. You're just great. Thank you very much. Join us please. Our guest, Professor Ronald Suny, director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies and professor of social and political history at the University of Michigan, also emeritus professor at the University of Chicago. We should have him with us again. He's good, don't you think? And you are, too. Thanks for all of your informed, great calls. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour and for on-air production.